Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
It's time to talk some football as we do every day at this time with the Professor John Clayton. Hello, John.
Hello, guys. Before we get started, can I say something?
Sure.
Okay. I just want to, because I know this is Brian Schoening's last day. He's on the board right now. He's been so helpful with the schooled with the professor for several months. I just wanted to wish him the best.
Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate that. It's been a pleasure working with you on that podcast since the beginning of the year, and I'm sure DJ's going to do an awesome job with you moving forward.
Okay. So thank you for that.
Yeah, good stuff. That was nice, John. That was nice. And as we tell you guys every day, if you've got questions for the professor, you just text them into 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line, and we'll try to get to some of those before we let John go for the day. John, we heard from L.J. Collier earlier today. He spoke with the media, and he was singing some of the same songs we've heard from guys about, you know, feeling disrespected because people are writing him off. But we loved what he was saying. He was talking about running through people's faces, and he was talking about, I can be great, and I know I can play at this level and have an impact and make noise. Is there any reason to doubt that he can do that? Last year was a disappointment, and that's different than calling the guy a bust. I think it was disappointing last year. I don't think it's the final story. The final story has not been written. What do you expect from him this year?
I expect a big jump. I don't know if I want to call it a breakout year, but I think maybe he can have a breakout year because I think he does have the best chance to be the five technique, unless they bring Devian Clowney back, which, you know, still looks unlikely. And I think he's going to do a good job. All I know is that the scouting report on him is, and particularly coming from his head coach in college, is that he's tough. He's got a good bull rush. He's got a good feel for the game, and he's got a great tenacity. And, you know, sometimes what ends up happening, and Dave knows this from watching rookies come in all the time, you either have two things go against you. One, you know, he got hurt, and at one point they thought he suffered a serious, maybe season-ending injury, which didn't turn out to be the case. But the other thing is the coaches, you know, were going more with the veterans and did not give him as many opportunities as he possibly could because, you know, it was one of those things where, okay, one week, if they had a run-stopping team, he was going to be inactive, and it kind of kept juggling like that. And that's not his fault. I mean, all he can do is try to practice, be available, but he can't pick the playing time, particularly being a rookie. So I think that and I think that's a good sign because when you listen to the way that he said it, doesn't it kind of remind you of what Jaron Reed sounded like in his first 2 years? Because, you know, Jaron, you know, is one of the alpha dogs from the Alabama team and, had that 10.5 season a couple years ago, did well and all those things and, you know, became a good leader in the locker room. Well, I don't know about the leadership part, but I think from the playing part, he's tough. And the only thing that's being held against him is that unfair thing of that first-round attachment because, you know, everybody knows that the way John Snyder works is that he'll target some people and hope to get them in the second round. But in the case of where it was going in the year that Collier was drafted last year is that the pass rushers are going off a little bit faster. And so the only way that he was going to be able to get Collier after he made the other trade down into the second round was to be able to take him in the first. And so, again, you know, just because he has that first round tag on him doesn't mean he can't be a good player, because I think he can be.
Yeah, and I liked the things that he said, John. And Bob put it really well. When people call someone a bust, that's when it's all said and done. And this guy, I think Bob used the word disappointing. Yeah, it was definitely disappointing, and probably nobody more disappointing than him. Disappointed than him because, you know, you come from the top of the heap, and then all of a sudden now you're just one of the guys. And I feel like kind of the reps are hurting guys a little bit too, because you're not getting as many live reps during practice, although I know he missed a lot of the ones that they did have during camp too. And that was one of the things you said, John, you know, the injuries, they'll kill you your rookie year.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, you saw that with Rasheem Green his first year. But now, as Pete Carroll so often says, that jump really happens from year one to year two. And I know that you appreciated the jump, even though it may not have been as big as everybody wanted with Rasheem Green from year one to year two. But a similar thing. You know, Rasheem had an injury, the knee injury, that kind of held him back coming out of college. It affected him for a good portion of his rookie season and kind of put him behind. But see, the difference between, you know, Green and Collier is that Green doesn't have that first round tag on him that saying, well, it's like, well, Green can't be a disappointment because he's a second round pick trying to get in there. But the Collier doesn't have that benefit because, again, even though the Seahawks probably would have preferred to take him in the second round, you still have everybody saying, oh, yeah, well, they took this Collier guy higher than they should. No, they took him because they like him and they think he can be a good player.
John, if they don't make any more additions to the defensive line, who do you think will lead the team in sacks, and how many will that number be?
Good question. I would have to think that, I say this, and I probably say it wrong. You know, I still think it can be Daryl Taylor at about 8 or 9, and I just have this feel that he could come back and win the starting job. And if that's going to be the case, you know, then I think he can do well. You know, because I think that you know, if he can get 8 or 9, you know, with Maioa, with Irvin, you know, with Collier, with Green, and all that stuff, and certainly you know, Jaron Reed, you know, I think they can get back to that 40 sack level. And if that's going to be the case, you know, I think that allows them to play more man defense, which I think they can do very well. I think it allows them to make more plays because, I mean, they played a lot of zone last year, and with the zone and not a lot of pressure on the quarterback, I mean, that created some problems.
Again, if you have questions for the professor, just text them into 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. We'll get to your questions before we let him go. We saw, John, that Matthew Judon signed his franchise tag number, and they've got till the 15th of July to work out a long-term deal for him. I don't know how realistic he was. He was a name that we always mentioned as a possibility for the Seahawks. Any surprise there, and any doubt that they'll get a deal worked out in Baltimore?
I don't know if they can get a deal worked out. I mean, that's where they might have a little bit of a problem because, again, all these teams are going to face the difficulty of trying to do long-term deals if the cap's not going to go up or if the cap's going to go down. The big thing for them is that they definitely had the plans to keep him. And I think, really, the fact that they weren't going to trade him again, they're going to listen. That's the best thing to do. But I think it may be hard for him to get that long-term deal, you know, because, again, what you end up seeing happen, and happen so many times, you either see the franchise pass rusher traded, which didn't happen this year, or you see him leave after the season. And remember, the Ravens are a team that expects to win anywhere between, you know, 11 and 14 games, and they're going to be, you know, drafting down at the bottom of the first round if that's going to be the case. And, you know, if that's the case, maybe what they do is that they don't re-sign him and they get a third-round compensatory.
With Judon, though, John, I mean, were people just putting two and two together? Okay, it might be a problem getting him signed. The Seahawks need a pass rusher. Or did you hear something in the back channels where they were ever seriously considering it?
Yeah,
I mean, we
I think
Snyder considers everything,
yeah,
right?
I don't know where Snyder was on it, but I know that you know, in the back of the minds of the Ravens, I mean, they're going to be a team that listens. Because they see, because remember, you know, this is one of the rare times they've actually kept the pass rusher. I mean, they've let so many guys go either in free agency and getting the compensatory pick. In this case, you know, they all of a sudden, I think, you know, let's say, for example, they won 8 or 9 games last year. Then I think there would have been more of a chance that they would have traded him to try to, you know, get a second round pick, if not a little bit more likely the second round pick, because, you know, if not, they would let him go and they get the third round compensatory. But the fact that they won 14 games, I know I talked to the Ravens today, and they're so excited about the linebacking core because they got Patrick Queen, and, you know, they were able to get Malik Harrison. So now all of a sudden they've got two young, quick linebackers added to the mix with Judon, who's their main pass rusher. They think this defense is going to be one of the better ones they put up since, you know, they've had the old days, you know, back in the 2000s, you know, with some great players on that team.
Hey, John, do you think that was kind of a fluke that they lost to the Titans in the playoffs last year?
No, I think we've seen this so much with young quarterbacks. You know, it's hard to be like a Russell Wilson and win your first playoff game. I mean, you notice that Dak Prescott didn't win his first playoff game. You know, Matt Ryan lost his first 3 playoff games. It takes time to learn what you need to do because you can have the great regular season and then all of a sudden you get into the playoffs and it's a different type of game. Now, you notice that wasn't a problem for Patrick Mahomes, but then Mahomes is a freak. I mean, he's, you know, probably at this stage one of the youngest, best quarterbacks we've ever seen, because he was so good, you know, in that second year when they sat him the first and they put him in the second. You know, he throws 50-some touchdown passes and now looks like one of the great finds in NFL history for quarterbacks. But, no, it's tough sometimes, and that's why, you know, a lot of times you see these quarterbacks, you know, they get that first playoff game and they lose, and so they have to come back and see how to figure out how to win these games. You know, Lamar was able to figure out what to do in the regular season, but he still needs to learn what to do in the playoffs. And, you know, if you notice, then that happens a bunch of times, they haven't figured him out yet, but I know I was talking to some of the Buffalo Bills people this week, and, you know, Sean McDermott did a pretty good job of containing Lamar Jackson. And if you go back to when you're looking at, Matt Patricia, you know, the great guy with the pencil, and no, the players don't like him. I mean, did a good job in that first week of December, you know, trying to find a way to stop that Rams running game 2 years ago. Well, that carried over for about 2-3 weeks. And so, you know, maybe there's some ways that they've been able to figure out Lamar Jackson, and that it worked in the playoffs.
John, the 509, or not the 509, I'm sorry, the 206 is looking for an update on Quentin Dunbar.
Nothing. I mean, that's in the court systems and the prosecutor's office, and nothing has been spoken by then. I mean, the last thing that has come out, which is, you know, kind of minor, you would guess, is that his attorney was tweeting out that, you know, it took 45 minutes after the departure of Dunbar and of, the cornerback, that that those 45 minutes when they called the police, which he thought was kind of suspicious, because why wait that long if you feel like you've got $73,000 robbed from you? So that's the most recent thing. But in this case, it's now up to the courts to do something, or at least the prosecutor's office.
Hey, John, Alden Smith. You know, he was talking on Pro Football Talk about how he lost his way, and football kind of gives him that way of getting his life back together. Guy's been through a lot of stuff. Says he's up to 285, and I'm just looking, he was listed at like 255. But man, this guy, I think he's 31 now, but he had a 19.5 sack season, a 14 sack season, 8.5 1 year. What do you think's going to be, how do you think that's going to turn out for Alden Smith?
I don't think that's a good number for him. I mean, because again, one of the things that he looked so good at was being a linebacker. Well, 285, he's not going to be a linebacker, particularly after not playing since 2015. So, you know, at 285, I mean, has he gone from being a linebacker to a five technique? Now, again, at this stage, they're still trying to figure out how much 3-4 and how much 4-3, because with Mike Nolan as the coach and on the defensive side, being the defensive coordinator, they want to kind of have a hybrid type of defense. But my way of thinking is Alden Smith fits in a little bit better than linebacker, than a defensive end. You know, he can rush the quarterback. He did such a good job when he was able to play. But 285 kind of scares me. And I think one of the concerns, you know, league-wide, I know some different scouts are even talking about this, is that, a lot of the guys, once they get to camp, are going to be not in good condition, because, you know, they're on their own. They're trying to do as much as they can, but it's just almost like back in the days in the 70s, where it's like, okay, you don't have the off-season program, and basically you come to camp to try to get in shape. At 285s, to me, that sounds like he's going to get to camp to try to get in shape.
John, the governor of Texas has said he's going to allow fans to go to outdoor stadiums. They can operate at 25% capacity. I assume, though, that if the NFL season starts, it's going to be universal everywhere, isn't it? If there are some stadiums where you can't have fans, then Texas won't be able to have them either?
No. I think what they'll do there is try to see what they can do to adjust, because again, I mean, people in the stands is money in the pocket, and they want the money in the pocket. And so I think they'll leave it up to the local governments to figure out what's going to happen, because, you know, right now it's not a go here in Seattle down at CenturyLink, you know, because they haven't opened things up yet, and I don't know if they will. That could be a question mark. But I think it's encouraging that, at least in Dallas and also in Houston, that, they can allow some people to go to the games. And so it's a matter of spacing things out. And so I think this is a city-by-city, county-by-county, state-by-state type of decision.
Do you think it's distinct? They distinguish between open air and dome stadiums?
I don't think so. No, I think it would be pretty much the same type of thing. Certainly you're going to have to work on the ventilation in the indoor stadiums, but I think that can be worked around. But again, trying to find the right way to space everybody 6 feet, trying to find the right way to make sure, do you have concessions? You don't have concessions. If you have concessions, how do you handle that? What about security? What about, do you take temperatures of people when they come into the stadium? All those things have to come into play and figure it out. Again, this is a state-by-state, city-by-city decision.
Hey, John, Melvin Gordon did something I did back in 1993, took a shot at his team on the way out. I probably shouldn't have done it, but...
That's pretty funny.
He said, when they were asking about not having any fans, he's like, yeah, well, we didn't have any fans anyway down there with the Chargers game, so I'm not missing too much. I thought that was pretty funny.
I thought that was pretty funny. I think we know it was pretty accurate, too. I still think that because, did they fill up the stadium at the StubHub, the old StubHub? Well, yeah, but the only way they filled up the stadium was with more non-Charger fans, fans from the other right. team, than they did with Charger fans. And I think the one classic example that I'm sure is rattling through his head was that game in 2018 at home against Arizona. That's when Arizona was in the tank, not doing well, and the Cardinal fans weren't going to fly to Los Angeles and go see the Charger Cardinal game. So there was so many empty seats, it was embarrassing.
John, I guess the assumption is that Chris Carson will lead the Seahawks again in rushing this year, but what about Carlos Hyde? What do you think his rushing total will be?
A lot of it's going to depend on the comeback of Rashad Penny, which, again, we anticipate he's going to miss the first 6 games. But I would have to anticipate that what ends up happening is that he'll come back, and I'd say right now he can probably be good for 400 to 500 yards, but if Penny comes back and reclaims the backup job, it will be less than that.
John, the 360 was asking, and again, you guys can text in questions, 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. They were asking about Britt, has he been signed? I told him they hadn't signed, nobody has signed him yet, but he or she were asking any chance the Seahawks could possibly re-sign him.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, it's unfortunate. It's an unfortunate injury, ended a very good Seahawk career, but, they have, three options that they'll be looking at because, I mean, B.J. Finney they signed as a possible starting center. Ethan Posick could be there to do it. And then, of course, I mean, you still have Joey Hunt, but no, I think that Justin, they cut him. They needed to cap room. He's probably not happy about it. I think that relationship is pretty well over, unfortunately.
All right, John, another guy we probably talk about as much as Clowney. Well, at least for a while we did. Unique Ngakoue, heard anything new there? Everything's really quieted down there because, it was like a month ago or something, the owner's son was going back and forth with him. Have we heard anything from him?
Absolutely nothing. And there's nothing to hear because he's not participating in the off-season program. He still doesn't want to be there. The trade value is now evaporated because, whether they wanted a first-round pick and a little bit more, they weren't going to get it. I mean, the value would have been for a high second-round pick, but that never materialized. And now with the fact that you're talking about next year's draft choice, it just simply is out of sight, out of mind. So I anticipate what you can expect is in July he won't show up for training camp and then see if he can pull a Clowney and get something traded by the end of camp.
John, the 425 wants to know if the Seahawks should trade for Jamal Adams.
No. Why would they do that? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Because he's a good player, John.
Okay, so you're going to give a first-round pick for Jamal Adams when you have, you can't get Marquise Blair on the field. You can't, right now, you're still trying to figure out if you can get Ugo Amadi on the field. I mean, you got Quentin Diggs, you got Quandre Diggs, and you've got Bradley McDougal. I mean, that would just be the stupidest thing in the world. No way possible. Because, again, it's a first-round pick.
How do you really feel, though, John?
If it's the stupidest thing possible.
Well, the guy was... John, wait a minute. Let me be the devil's advocate here. He was drafted 6th overall just 3 years ago, so even if you were giving up a first-round pick, you'd be getting a pretty quality player in return.
Yeah, but you're going to have to pay him over $14 million a year. Can you afford to do that with a $35 million quarterback? And right. The need
Why
to
do I get in these debates with you, Professor?
And then the need to re-sign either Shaquille Griffin or Chris Carson or Quentin Dunbar. I mean, so in other words, if you make that trade, you lose your first round pick in that value, and you probably cost yourself two players. to re-sign.
John, the 425 wants to know if Dunbar is suspended, and we, as you just said, we have no idea what's going to happen there. But if he is, hypothetically, do the Seahawks go out and sign another corner, or do they stick with what they've got?
Depends on how, on the timing of it and Trey Flowers and what's going on there. You know, if they, and again, I can't anticipate anything happening very soon right now because now it's tied up in the court system and they're not going to move too quickly. So, you know, I would have to think that they'd have to consider doing something. I mean, again, that would be like a Logan Ryan move at $3 million or something like that. But I still, you know, you have to think he still has a chance to at least have this case dropped if you believe his attorney and the five testimonies that he got sworn from the victims who no longer say they're victims.
Hey, John, I heard, first of all, somebody, I can't remember who it was, 253 maybe, asked what's going to be Dak Prescott's final number when he gets signed. And then also this morning I heard people talking about, like, Patrick Mahomes, that it's like a foregone conclusion that he's going to be like a $40 million man. You agree with that?
I agree with that, yeah, because I think he takes it to the next level and he's that good. In the case of Dak, I know that he's resisting the five-year contract, and I'm on board with him on that because, you know, for the most part, second contracts for quarterbacks are usually 4 years, and right now, you know, they're offering a little less than $35 million, less than Russell Wilson, but they want a five-year deal. So I'd have to think that maybe the concession could be you do a four-year deal at $34.9 million, but I don't know if he'd go for that.
Professor, what do you find the age limit is typically for a left tackle? I'm bringing that up because of Dwayne Brown. He turns 35 in August. Is he going to be like Andrew Whitworth getting another three-year deal by the time he's 38?
No, I doubt that. No, I think that he's on a year-by-year basis. And you notice there was a big drop-off in Whitworth last year. And what was he, 37 last year? And so I think that, I mean, Jason Peters, of course, I think what he was 38, and they didn't bring him back with the Eagles, although they're still thinking about it, but they didn't bring him back. But, you know, you can, I think, you know, at the very most, you can go to 37, 38. But again, you have some exceptions. I mean, some guys are able to go a little bit longer. But I'd say right now, you know, it's, you know, one or two more years for Brown.
John, quickly before we let you go, the 509 is asking about Alshon Jeffrey and if he's going to be a big key to the Eagles' offense, despite criticism that he laid against Carson Wentz, I guess, speaking with Josina Anderson. I hadn't heard that criticism. What did he say?
Well, I mean, I think it was one of the broadcasters back in Philly that said that, but you know, and it was interesting in somebody bringing that up because somebody in Philly tweeted out today that they anticipate that the only way that Jeffrey's going to be on the roster is going to be if he's on injured reserve, start the season on injured reserve. And really, if you think about it, I mean, I think he's at the end, the very end of his career. I think he's lost his speed. Certainly, I'm not saying he's not held in big favor with Philadelphia, but they're ready to move on from him. But he's coming off injury, and right now it's not looking good.
John, you doing your show tomorrow?
Yes, indeed, from 8 to 9.
8 to 9, taking phone calls with the professor, so tune in for that. John, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Okay, sounds good.
There you go. If you missed any of today's Cold Hard Facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, just download the podcast at 710sports.com. Well, settle in, get comfy. It's time for Dave Wyman's story time with all the rule proposal talk this week. He's going to go with a story involving officials. So stay tuned for that. It's coming up next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
I brought you a special present.
What is it?
Open it up.
As I was limping over there to beat him, if you grab the guy's face mask and twist his head, then like I tried to do to Terry Obie that cut me into the mud, you know, that is something that's different, and that's a penalty.
The violence of Dave Wyman is a beautiful thing. It really is. And it often is on display during story time. I don't think it'll be in this version, but we always look forward to this every Friday. Story time with Dave Wyman. What do you have for us today, Dave?
Yeah, I thought I'd give a little shout out to the officials because we had Dean Blandino on the other day, and I don't know why, I just get along with those guys. And every year when they come to camp to do like a presentation, it's funny because I typically don't ask questions, you know, in like Pete's press conferences or anything like that. But I usually do in those just because, I don't know, I feel like they, you know, they'll answer your questions. They've always been helpful. Now, I'll start off by saying I've had, and I think everybody has had bad experiences with officials, you know, and a lot of times it's at the lower level. When I was coaching at Interlake High School in 2007, those kids, I had such a bond with. They were like my kids. And one of the kids, Alan Lampe, there was another kid named B. Nguyen. Alan Lampe asked me to come to his wedding like 6 or 7 years later. And it was in Hawaii and I couldn't make it. It was during the season. But I just had this great connection with these guys. But, you know, it was like parenting. You know, there's good and bad. And I was out on the field. It was our last game of the year. And I'm out there and I used a bad word. But, you know, they all took it and they knew that's what it was all about. And I'm like, what the, you know, bleep is this or something like that.
What?
And this official come over. Yeah. And I had the official come over and they all were looking at me like, yeah, coach, you're right. And he comes over there and he goes, hey, not on my field. And I'm like, first of all, this is not your field. Okay. And second of all, these are my kids, man. This is like you coming over and disciplining me, in my parenting skills. It just tweaked me. And so, sometimes you get that where those guys think, hey, I'm the show. I'm in charge. Not that often though. And hardly ever in the NFL. I hardly ever saw that. And then, you know, another bad experience for me was in the Cal game in 1982, the play, you know, with the pitch and the kickoff and the bands on the field. There was a play in that game where I watched the ball bounce off the turf and into the receiver's hands, and they called it a touchdown for Cal. And I was just screaming and yelling, and I was like, no, you can't call that a touchdown. And the guy's like, you better get out of my face or I'm going to flag you. And I was a freshman, you know, but I mean, I watched that ball bounce off the turf. That was not a touchdown, but you know, and he just got super aggressive. But that was, has not been my experience in the NFL. And I think the first time I ever, really noticed or kind of interacted, I think it was my second year where I was starting and we were playing the Broncos. Do you guys remember Jim Tunney? I think he was like the first, like most recognizable official where, you know, everybody knew who Jim Tunney was. He was kind of the head guy. So, I'm chasing Elway out of the pocket. He throws the ball away and I just kind of give him this shove and he didn't fall down or anything like that. But, and so Tunney, as I'm walking back to the huddle, he comes up and goes, so, was that some little Stanford love tap there? And I was like, I don't know, you know, and so he's like, don't do that again. Yeah. You do that again. I'm going to have to flag you. And that was like most of the interaction that I had with the officials is that they were there to help you and they're going to tell you, hey man, you better watch out for this because, you know, I'm going to have to call you on it. But the other one I had, I told you guys, well, I told Blandino the other day, there was this guy named Bob Wagner. I don't know why I ended up getting him. The only reason I remembered him is because he was a nice guy. He was big. He was like 6'5" and kind of a bigger guy. He had his jersey number. You know, I don't know if you've noticed this. The officials have numbers. He was number 100. And so I don't know why I got him in a lot of games. So we kind of had like a repertoire We had like a relationship kind of, you know, where I'd say hi to him and stuff like that. But there was this time in Pittsburgh where, I was getting held and the guy, it was like a WWE takedown I was getting from these guards. And it was like a hurry up thing. And I'm screaming and yelling at him and getting up and getting back, you know, lined up and then, you know, screaming at him again. And then, you know, finally we get like a TV timeout and he comes over and he's like, so, Dave, what's going on? And I'm like, I'm getting just mobbed out here by these guys. They're grabbing me. They're holding me. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And he goes, okay, well, I'll try to watch out for it. And I said, yeah, well, you better hurry up because I'm starting to like it. And he goes, oh, you know, that really hurts, Dave. Yeah, it really hurts, you know, and then we just kind of chuckled about it, but that was usually the kind of interaction. Probably the best one though was, what was the guy's name? There was a special team player named Benny something. He's for the Chiefs. And I've told you guys, like, I really loved being the up back on the field goal, you know, kick team. I was the, the guy, you know, that's kind of cocked sideways 45 degrees out on the edge. And they called it, you're the double bumper, you know, where you have to hit a guy inside and then I would wait and then dive outside to knock the guy off who's rushing off the edge. Well, they had this guy named Benny something or other. He was a donkey. He really was. I hated him. And, he was just a, he's just not a very good guy. So, you know, he would do all kinds of stupid things on the field and everything. But so his, their plan when we were playing the Chiefs is that he was going to come in and tackle me. And so basically I couldn't get to the outside guy and we almost got a field goal blocked, because of it. So he just grabbed me and held me. And so I got in this big fight with him and we're not like throwing punches, but you know, close to it and getting really mad. And I was just, I was so hot. I mean, I was screaming and yelling and I wanted to kill this guy. And you know, and I'm screaming at the official and everything. And so we, a little bit after that, he comes over to me. I'm in my huddle. I'm calling my huddle. And he comes over and it was a short time after it and I was still mad. And so he comes in and he's like, Hey, Dave, what's going on out there? And I looked at him. I go, get the bleep out of my huddle. Get the hell out of here. Right. And just start screaming and yelling at him. And you would think, you know, oh, you know, the guy from high school football would have, you know, thrown a flag or something. He put his hands up. And he started kind of laughing and he started backing away. And he's like, okay, we'll talk later. No problem. And I just so appreciated that. And sure enough, you know, probably 5 minutes later, I went over to him, you know, I just made a point during a timeout and I go, hey man, here's what's happening. You know, I'm trying to get out to that second guy and this guy's tackling me and it's happened a couple of times. And he's like, okay, yeah, you're right. You know, I'll take a look at it. And I threatened the guy verbally, this Benny guy, Benny Thompson. I can't remember his name. And he didn't come over to my side the next time, which, yeah, cause I was like, I'm going to kill you if you come over here. I'm going to stomp you or something. All the rage is starting to come back right now of playing in a game. You just get into this. Like,
fired up,
ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, you just get you play angry all the time. But I just, again, and I tried to look for the guy's name. I couldn't remember, you know, exactly who he was. But I just so appreciated that part of it, and I just hope that never goes away because I see a lot in Major League Baseball where those guys get a big chippy attitude and they think that they're part of the show. And, you know, and I mentioned this about Gene Steratore a little bit, that he kind of walks around like he's, you know, one of the big shots. I saw him in the hallway after a game one time and I'm like, oh man, those are not the officials I remember. But I was talking to some of those guys last year when they came around, and there's two guys that played that are actually, became officials last year. Terry Killens, who was a linebacker, and a guy named Nate Jones, who played not too long ago. And I think Jones played for New England a little bit, and Killens, I'm not sure. I think he played for the Oilers a while back, but I think one of those guys was there and I was talking to him, but you know, I love those guys. They're there to help. But again, you know, like we talked about with Dean Blandino, it's not their fault, man. They're trying to do the best job they can. They don't want to be noticed. They don't want to be recognized. They're humble. That's just kind of the culture that they have, you know? And, but really what it is the playbook has not even quadrupled. I mean, it's probably 10 times as long as it used to be at the turn of the century, even. I mean, even in the last 20 years. So these guys are trying to get all this stuff done. And I know Professor disagrees with me on this, but I think that they should make them full-time employees where, you know, they're able to get paid year-round just to be officials, because most of those guys have other jobs that they're doing. But they take a tremendous amount of pride in it, and I've always really appreciated the NFL officials.
Yeah, and it sounds like they're polar opposite from baseball umpires, the majority of them anyway, who are very, exactly. Very much in the spotlight and sensitive and don't want to, you can't even look at them. So, very different world when dealing with those that are on the field.
I heard an MLB guy real quick say one time, he goes, you can say this word and you can say that word, but don't put you on it. You can say bleep, but don't say bleep you. And that was kind of one of the things. But I don't know. I mean, sometimes, you know, in football, I think it's different because you're so fired up and you get angry and your emotions so much more involved. So they're a little bit more forgiving. But like I said, it's mostly the culture that's passed down.
Yeah. All right. Good stuff. We look forward to story time with Dave Wyman every Friday. Coming up, Melvin Gordon takes a shot at his former team, and J.J. Watt is at a loss for words when he's asked what makes Bill O'Brien a good coach. We're going to hear about that when we sweep the dial. Coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
How would it feel if you go into these games and there's no fans in the stadium? I know there's been a lot of talk about there being fanless games. Like, could you imagine playing a football game with no fans or there being crowd noise pumped into the stadium?
Bro, we didn't have fans anyway.
Oh, man. Charger fans. They're not going to like
that. Okay. We didn't have many Charger fans. I'm going to be honest. We didn't have many Charger fans at the game. You know, much loyalty, love, but we ain't had many, so I'm not missing anything.
He's not wrong. That's Melvin Gordon talking to Marcus Cromartie in an interview that, you know, he was like, what's that going to be like? That'll be new. And didn't really have fans. I mean, they played in, what, a 25,000-seat, 30,000-seat stadium out there in L.A., and they couldn't fill that. So, there were people there, but he's right. Compared to every other NFL city and stadium, nobody was there.
Yeah, well, and like the professor said, there's a couple times where the opposing team just dominated. I think I want to say Pittsburgh, maybe some Green Bay fans came down there, but I'll tell you what,
they did that for the couple Rams games too. Remember that?
Yeah, the Rams. Yeah, have you guys been down to that stadium? What is it called? StubHub.
Nope. Yeah, I went to a fight there. They had HBO had a fight there before. That when I lived down there, I went to a fight there.
It's an awesome stadium. I mean, it doesn't hold very much, but like, it kind of sunk down, so they have like a plaza all the way around with like really good, you know, food and little bars and stuff like that. And then you kind of walk mostly down into the stadium on parts of it anyway. And it's really a cool setting, and it could be fairly loud in there, you know, when they get it going. Because I was just there for preseason games, but yeah, it's weird that, you know, that there's that few fans in an NFL game. And you mentioned the Rams too, and really Arizona. You know, Arizona does that count of how many offsides penalties they have. Like, they're second to Seattle, I guess. That is not because of crowd noise down there, because a lot of times you see, you know, just as many Seahawk fans down there as Arizona fans.
Yeah, when I saw that about Melvin Gordon, I was thinking, okay, if I'm a San Diego Chargers fan, I love hearing that from him. But if I'm an L.A. Chargers fan, I'm marking that one down when they play the Broncos and when fans are allowed back in L.A. to come to a Chargers home game, and I'm probably booing the heck out of Melvin Gordon when he comes back.
What makes Bill O'Brien a good head coach? He's got two new play callers with him. It's a little bit different role. What makes him good at leading this team?
I think his job is to do just that, is to lead the team, is to, obviously he's more of an offensive guy than a defensive guy, so it's to lead the overall team, but then to lead the offense, and now with his other roles as well, is to general manage, is to do everything within the organization. That's his role, and I think that's what obviously he excels at, so.
Yeah, but JJ, what makes him a good coach? Not what are his duties, what is he responsible for? What makes him a good coach? that was such a non-answer right there by JJ Watt.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about Bill O'Brien. I don't like him. He didn't come off well in that Hard Knocks.
Hard Knocks.
You know, episode that they did. I almost called it Breaking Bad, Bob. But yeah, he just didn't come off as a great leader. And then I was watching this Peyton Places thing where he went down to Houston and with J.J. Watt, and he was throwing him passes and stuff. And J.J. Watt's caught a number of touchdowns and extra points. And they actually, Peyton threw him a slant in one of the Pro Bowls. You know, they lined him up out there. And so then he's like, yeah, you got to talk to your coach. So then Bill O'Brien comes down there. And it was kind of the same thing. Like they both, you could see the looks on their faces that, and what he was saying was just not very, you know, funny or entertaining or cool or anything. Like if you get a guy like Tony Dungy down there, you know, he's going to have a big smile and everything. But Bill O'Brien just came off as really, and you could kind of tell just the body language and everything that J.J. Watt and Peyton Manning didn't care much for him. So, yeah, I don't, he wins, right?
Well, yeah, I'm just looking at his record here, Dave, and maybe as GM, Texans fans can't stand him, especially trading Hopkins to Arizona, but he gets results. He's been there 6 years. He's had five winning seasons. They've been in the playoffs five times, and the Texans have won the AFC South four times, and they're coming off seasons of 11-5 in 2018 and 10-6 in 2019. So maybe J.J. Watt doesn't think much of him as a coach from those comments, but boy, he's sure getting the job done there in Houston.
I think David Price made a tremendous statement today on that way. He understands. He understands, you know, that people are hurting, and he's taking money out of his own pocket to give to that. At the same time, also understanding that the brethren is going to stand firm in what they believe in as well. So I think he's doing a good job of showing both the compassion, but at the same time that, you know, things got to be agreed upon for us to get out on that field. But, you know, I think that was a big step to kind of show the humanity side of the players. And nobody better to do that than David Price, because that's just who he is, and that's what he represents. And to be able to, you know, pay every minor league player out of his own pocket in that Dodgers organization is a tremendous, you know, gesture.
That's pretty cool. That's the voice of former big leaguer Michael Kadire on the MLB Network Sirius Radio, talking about David Price offering to pay $1,000 of his own money to each minor leaguer in the Dodgers system. Total of almost $200,000. So he's looking at spending almost $200,000. I mean, what do you say? That's an awesome gesture, especially in a time where you, again, not to beat up on the A's, but yes, to beat up on the A's. They couldn't figure out a way to pay their minor leaguers. A multi-billionaire paid their minor leaguers $400 a week through the end of their regular season. And you got this guy who individually is going to pay him $1,000 out of his own pocket each. So it was somewhere around $200,000. An awesome gesture by David Price.
Well, and I see Shin Soo-Chu did the same thing for the Rangers.
Yeah, he did. He
did. Back in April. So that's, I mean, those guys are going to be much beloved, and that's just a really cool gesture, and really kind of shameful for a team like the A's. You know, like, oh, you're gonna, okay, you don't want to do that, all right, well, I'll do it. And yeah, I like that. I wonder the taxes and everything, how it works out, you know, because you can gift money, but you know, I don't know how they're gonna set that up. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. It's just, the point is, what a great teammate David Price and Shin Soo-Chu, both those guys are.
Yeah, I'm with you guys on that, and I think I'm not so sure about Price, but Shin Soo-Chu, I mean, those guys understanding what minor leaguers go through, the bus trips, all the long rides, everything, the bad food, the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and everything that they have to endure. And so, yeah, good for David Price. I was just curious, and so I looked it up, and I was like, okay, David Price, man, $200,000 that he's donating to the minor leaguers or giving to him, and he's making $32 million this year, or was scheduled to make $32 million this year, but I guess that doesn't matter. I was just curious, like I said, but very cool of him to do that.
Yeah, really, really cool. Really cool. Again, that's the silver lining to a lot of what's going on. You're seeing a really good side to a lot of people and different businesses and things like that. So very cool to highlight that. All next week, 710 ESPN Seattle will celebrate Mariners Legends Week. You heard us talk about this a bit, but we're going to have interviews with Mariner Hall of Famers and all-time greats across all of our shows. It's going to happen all week long, so don't miss a single moment. You can follow along, listen on air, listen online, or with the 710 Sports app. I'm not exactly sure who we're going to have. I know we have Jamie Moyer lined up for 5 o'clock next Wednesday. We may have somebody in addition to him, but all the shows will have somebody different throughout the week. So a really cool thing going on. Make sure you tune in for that. We've been traveling further and further down the rabbit hole of the Let Russ Cook, or the cooking people, as Jim likes to call them. And now it's time to have someone on who can speak for that community. He's the leader of the Let Russ Cook people, I think. Maybe we'll, I don't know if he acknowledges that. We'll see. Jake Heaps, he's going to join us next here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.